Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome, everyone, back to Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. And today, I have the pleasure of hosting, once again, Richard Hanania, who kicked my ass last time about realism in foreign policy. And I'm a bit of a glutton for punishment, so I wanted to bring him back to actually talk about domestic politics in the United States, specifically because I love how I'm on Richard's mailing list. And so I got his email. Like, literally how this happened was I got Richard's email on Capitol Hill craziness was the subject line. And, you know, and I realized like we had this great opportunity, Richard and me, to be able to talk about like what's actually going on and what is possibly in store for the future of the United States without a lot of like the sensationalism and posturing that I think we've seen a lot of. And so I figured it'd be a great episode. So Richard, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thanks, Eric.
So it's just going to be me and Richard today. Xander's on like kind of work vacation. And so we're experimenting a little bit with, hey, you know, can we hold up the show when like, you know, if one of us is so busy that the other one takes over for a little bit. So, you know, email me at eric@reconsidermedia.com. Just telling me how much you miss Xander. Maybe email him as well, so he'll come on more. But Richard and I are going to have a great time talking about like one fundamental question I have that I feel like Richard's really prepared to help us with is how much does the Capitol Hill craziness, right, the insurrection, the riot, whatever we want to call it, how much is it going to change our DNA as a country? And so here's how I'm thinking about this. The big question in my mind is, you know, I was 14 when 9/11 happened. And so I was just old enough to have this like strong sense of what America was and who we were. And it radically changed after that, right? And maybe not so radically, but it felt radical to my young mind. And a lot of things like you explain to people who were born in the late 90s, early 2000s, you say like, oh yeah, back in the day, like you could just like roll up through a metal detector and you were right by the plane. It's like, wow, you know, and other long-term changes came in the United States, like spying on our own people became just a thing. A constant vigilance about the war on terror became a thing. We made some big foreign policy mistakes in relation to it. So it was highly consequential. And now we've had a mob storm the Capitol building. Some people zip ties trying to find, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence and do God knows what to them. Congress is probably pissed as hell about it. And a lot of Americans are spooked by it. So we've got some specific questions that I might want to cover regarding what is Congress going to do? What's Silicon Valley going to do? What's the security apparatus going to do? But I want to start, Richard, for you, the most open question is, when the dust settles, or as the dust is settling, do you think America is going to look fundamentally different for this? Or is there just going to be kind of like a mop-up operation or closer to a mop-up operation and then back to business as usual?
Well, I think back to 9/11 and like you, I mean, I that was a formative event in my life too. How much it changed American culture? I don't know, like the air, you know, the, I think that after the collapse of the Berlin, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. There was a, that interim between the Cold War and 9/11, It was basically the foreign policy of the United States was like, we're just going to go fight these bad guys across the world. So like Milosevic and Saddam and these little sort of wars of choice that nobody was really paying attention to. And right. sort of was the response to 9/11 too. So it, and at the government level, though, it was huge because we spent trillions of dollars on these wars. We lost thousands of lives. We killed hundreds of thousands of people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And we gave up a lot of civil liberties that we never got back. So it was huge politically. Culturally, I don't know if the shift was all that great. This thing, I think it's going to have less of an effect on the culture, which, you know, the culture of the cultural effect of 9/11 wasn't that big to begin with. And then on policy, yeah, also much, much less of an effect. It's sort of things can happen when you have this sort of bipartisan consensus in one way or another. And then everybody, so after 9/11, Bush's approval rating was something like 80 or 90%, right? And then it's drifted downwards over time. And it was still pretty high when they went into Iraq in early 2003. This is a purely partisan thing. So now we're more partisan than we were about 20 years ago. And there's no, you know, president, there's no president who can unify the country anymore. So, Biden, I saw he had some pretty good approval ratings the other day. It was something like plus 20, which is unheard of. You're like, Trump never had that, but it's not that unheard of in the wider presidential history. And as far as how politicians are reacting, so a mob went to try to basically lynch Mike Pence, encouraged by Trump, and then they had an impeachment vote in the House of Representatives, and 10 Republicans out of, I think, 205 or something like that, voted to convict him. So 5% of them. There's no general consensus about the meaning of this thing. To some Republicans, they're saying, you know, nobody's saying, or very few people are saying that this was good. They're saying that this is a bad thing, this is embarrassing, but you know, let's not be divisive. Let's some Republicans in the Senate are saying, let's not even have the impeachment trial. You can't have a trial after the president has already left office. And so they're trying to get out. They're trying to find a way not to have to either have this trial. And if they do, and if they go ahead with it, I'm sure that they won't convict. And so you have this partisanship, and it's still there. And I think the Republicans are just ready to move on. The Democrats, they can't unify the country behind some kind of mission to have some kind of truth and reconciliation commission or anything like that. I think those poor foolish people who charge Capitol Hill are going to be charged, and the book is going to be thrown at them. I don't know how much the rest of us have to worry.
One of the ways I'm curious about how this changes our landscape for the short term is the Republican Party itself, right? So, you know, I think a lot of people were wondering, you know, at what point are Republicans, you know, our Republican leaders going to just have enough of Trump? And maybe it was, you know, maybe they kept, maybe their like personal distaste for him kept being a non-factor, specifically because he, you know, look, he, in a lot of ways, he brought home the bacon, right? And he was very popular among Republicans, and opposing Trump was just going to get you in trouble. But, you know, you have folks like Murkowski and Cheney, obviously Romney, but Romney always went his own way. But even McConnell, right, coming out and doing as much as McConnell is ever going to do to take a stand on, you know, on his own president, I think, saying, you know, maybe getting rid of him is not a bad idea. And I suspect, here's my own speculation, that there's some fear that the Republicans have going forward, that Republican leaders have going forward, that Trump is going to remain so popular among Republican voters that all he can really do is cause trouble. And my own like pet theory on this is that, you know, if Trump runs in 2024, is he going to get the nomination? I don't know. But if he does get the nomination, is he going to win the presidency? Absolutely not. Right. And so, you know, there's a sense that ongoing Trump remains a liability for the Republican Party, a distraction. You know, he keeps stopping around trying to, you know, I read a headline of an article. I haven't even had time to dig into it, that Trump might be forming a MAGA party. Right, that specifically going after Republicans who voted to impeach or convict him, to primary them, right, and try to purge the party of the old guard and keep it Trump's party, stuff like that. And so I'm wondering if you know, is Trump going to just like fade quietly into the night? Maybe this is like, maybe his personality is a big factor in this. Like, how much does he want to stay in the fight versus like, you know, golf? And I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think on that last point, I think this guy likes to fight. I think starting a new party is probably a little bit too much work. Some people have speculated about starting a TV channel or taking over a TV channel. That's also a lot of work. I think he likes running for president, which basically is him just flying around and giving speeches and having people cheer for him. And I think he liked being president too. He didn't like the work part, but he did a lot of work. I mean, he seemed to be enjoying himself and had a lot of time for Twittering and watching TV. So yeah, I think he wants to be president again. Before this happened, before the storming of Capitol Hill, I thought he was the favorite to be the nominee again. And I think he'd still be the favorite if they didn't take his social media away. I mean, I think that's bigger than the actual backlash to what happened. Look, the McConnells of the world wouldn't have wanted him to come back and be president anyway. They were always going to be against him.
Well, and they were against him at the beginning too, right? So it didn't, you know, the Republican leadership hating him in 2016 didn't exactly stop him from showing up.
Exactly. And, you know, the polling is, you know, if you look at the polls, it's like, do you want Trump to run again or somebody like Trump or something like that? I mean, maybe there's nobody like Trump and they end up with, but if it's like 33% say they want Trump and it's like 2016 again, where 15 people run for the nomination, you know, having 30% can win it. I don't know. You said he couldn't win a presidency if he won the nomination. I see no reason why not. I mean, he came very, very close this time. If bad things happen during the Biden administration, if there's an economic downturn or something that happens, I see no reason why he couldn't win the rematch. I mean, this Capitol Hill thing is, there's a backlash to it, but people's memories tend to be short. I mean, Trump has done so many outrageous things that, you know, the one more outrageous thing on top of it, and then letting a few years pass, people's memories will start to fade on that. So I don't know how much staying power it's damaged good, but the big problem for him is, like I said, social media being taken away. And then the fact that he's sort of in this place where he's like canceled, corporation. Like, I don't think like any, you know, like stuff like if he wanted to host some kind of fundraiser somewhere or something, like, you know, even Josh Hawley had one of his fundraisers canceled recently. So that's going to be hard, just being canceled across sort of corporate America and big tech. I don't know how he does it. You know, you can go around the establishment when you have social media, when you have these channels. When you don't have that, it's much more difficult. Now, another thing we haven't talked about is another difficulty in his way is he's got some legal problems. He's got tax issues, some issues with his foundation, maybe some stuff on like obstruction of justice during the presidency. He's got civil suits. He was doing a bunch of tax write-offs and he was doing some funny accounting before he became president. And he personally owes some ridiculous amounts of money, I think in the hundreds of millions. There was a Time story on this, and he's got to find a way to pay that off. He's also got civil cases, so these women are suing him for, I think, either sexual assault or libel for denying sexual assault and saying that they were liars. So he's going to be buried. He's going to be buried in lawsuits and potentially criminal prosecutions. And between that and the social media, it's going to be hard. I don't envy his situation right now.
So, yeah. And so it sounds like if we're thinking about Donald Trump as a force of nature rather than a man, you know, it's possibly not a bad model, but it sounds like what you're focusing on that I hadn't really thought about is that to some extent, his ability to control the narrative has been greatly curtailed. And that's going to make life really hard for him because all these lawsuits are going to crop up and there's going to be all this press about him. But he doesn't have the megaphone that he did to be able to just say it's fake news or make fun of the people who, you know, who are behind it. You know, he can't, you know, specifically because he can't tweet about it. And probably unless he ends up becoming a TV celebrity, which he might again, I suppose, you know, he doesn't so much have a platform to be able to, again, make his own narrative about what's going on around him. Now, the wacky part is, you know, to what extent, you know, for the people who still like Donald Trump at this point, you know, after everything that's happened over the past 5 years or so, doesn't even matter. And maybe that's, I guess, you know what, let's just go down that route is like, you know, if we speculate a little bit about his lasting appeal as a force of nature, as a political force of nature, you know, is it, you know, do we have any evidence that people are fundamentally attracted to, you know, really what he's saying? Like they want to hear the guy speak and that he actually like really, really touches them with his tweets and his speeches. Is it at this point you know, like people's conception of who he is. Like, however, you know, everyone's got their own version of Donald Trump that they've got hanging around in their minds at this point. And is that version so solid and unassailable, you know, regardless of which version it is? Is it the Nazi monster, or is it like God's chosen, you know, God's chosen tool on earth? But is that so unassailable that none of this matters? Is it that, you know, maybe it's the case that, you know, his lack of tweeting means that he's just going to kind of fade, right? He'll go out with a whimper, and people will like move on at some point because they're not hearing from him. They're not being reminded of him anymore.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you imagine if he still had Twitter right now while all this Biden stuff, he would have been trolling the inauguration. Yep. He would have been trolling Biden's executive orders. And Twitter and the internet, I mean, it honestly have a little bit of withdrawal. It feels like a little empty. It feels like you're at a party and there was one guy who was like dominating the conversation, just like the center of attention. And that guy left and everyone is just sort of like looking at each other and they don't know what
you
to
sound
do.
You sound almost sad.
There's like everyone is incompetent. I mean, so the other thing with his ability to control the narrative is, so if you remember back in 2015 when he announced for presidency, yeah. He would go and he had this initial announcement where he said, Mexico, they're sending us all their rapists. They're not sending us our best. These people are rapists. And that was the first thing was covered live on CNN. And you can go back to YouTube and you can watch the reaction on CNN. And they're just like, they're about to crack up. They just think it's hilarious. Right. And CNN starts carrying every single one of his rallies. Like there's 10, 15 people running at this time for the Republican primary. And these guys can't even get on TV because it's just the Trump show all the time. I remember I was once in the gym, like in the locker room, and they're just playing his rally. They're just playing his rally there. And like people are sort of standing around and watching and like smiling and laughing and being entertained. I mean, the free press that they gave him just because they thought he was good for ratings, right. I mean, was off the chart. And Fox back then was trying to stop him. Like everyone thought like, oh, he's not going to be the nominee. If he gets the nomination, he's going to lose. So like Fox was like worried about the good of the Republican right. Party. And, you know, they still had him on all the time. He was still good for ratings. But they, you know, you could tell the anchors and the personalities were largely against right. him. And CNN and MSNBC were just giving him unlimited time on TV. That's not going to happen this time. He's a sort of a very canceled yes. person. At this point. And the media now believes they have this idea that they have like a moral obligation to stomp out what they consider hate speech and untruth. In 2015, 2016, there was different norms. Social media was free.
Yes.
You could say basically whatever you want. You couldn't get kicked off of Twitter. And so you had this free internet. You had cable news just like giving all day over to Trump. And that's how he dominated the conversation. Right. Now, every piece of that is gone as a reaction to Trump. Like CNN is not going to cover his rallies when he announces next time. They're not going to let him say things unchecked. They're going to like, you know, fact check him every minute, but just probably just like try not to give him the attention. If he goes on, if they ever let him back on Twitter and Facebook and he starts saying things that are untrue or things that they consider quote unquote hateful, they're going to ban him again. People who are most excited about him, you know, all those people, some of those meme warriors who are in Trump's 2015 are gone from the internet. You know, if new ones pop up, they'll be squelched by
the whack-a-mole game.
The Republican Party is going to be happy, and Republican Party is going to be happy that all this is being done because they don't have to vote to convict him or have that vote in the Senate. After you convict him, you can vote to bar him for office right. again. Like I think if there was an anonymous vote, the Republicans would do that. But they want the media and they want big tech and the legal system, you know, which we always have to put in the background. They want them to do their work right. for them. And they might. I mean, Trump getting back to the nomination he's going to have a lot of hurdles, and each one is very, very difficult. Now, I'll say at the same time, he's got a stranglehold on 25-30% of the party at least. And if you can count on that, and it's a big field, it can work out for you. He can be discredited with the mass of the population. He can be discredited among most Republicans. The problem with 2016 was they couldn't. One reason that he won, he might have won anyway. But one reason that made it easier for him to win is that nobody, people didn't drop out right. early, right? So they were splitting the vote the whole time. The 2020 Democratic primary, as a way of comparison, it would look like it was going to be Sanders. Sanders yep. was hot in the first yep. few primaries, and before Super Tuesday. Klobuchar drops out, endorses Biden. Buttigieg drops out, endorses Biden. The party came together at some point and said, look, it's going to be Biden or Sanders. We don't want it to be Sanders. And they threw their weight behind Biden. If the Republican Party had done that in 2016, I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't have worked. But they didn't because, I mean, the other guy who was doing well was right. Ted Cruz. And the Republican establishment hated Ted Cruz too. So they were sort of stuck. They really didn't have any good options. Would they be able to come together and get behind somebody in 2024? I don't know why they would. I mean, there's a lot of people who are going to be running, and I don't see who. Well, it's a collective action problem. Right. I don't know who's going to just get out of the way. Who's going to be getting out of the way for everyone for one person? So there's no obvious like single individual who's going to challenge Trump. You just have a bunch of senators who maybe have Pence vice president, and those people can split the vote, and Trump can come back. So there's a. I'll be fascinated to see how this shakes out because it can easily go in either direction.
I think this is a great thing to play on in particular because I've always I'm not an innovator in this field of thinking about tribalism and in-group out-group theory, but one of the models about the world that I always kind of carry around with me is is this idea that do you watch The Expanse? The sci-fi show?
No.
Okay, that's okay, fine.
No, I
so
do not.
Well, for those who do watch, there's this moment. So if you all know Amos Burton, there's this moment that I won't try to spoil that like something really bad happens. And when something really bad happens, society starts to break down. And Amos says, civilization keeps us simple, or keeps us civil. And, we are tribal animals. And the thing that changes about us is not how tribal we are, but the size of our tribe. And that size of that tribe shrinks and grows, grows and shrinks due to essentially two things. Like one, how safe we feel, and two, do we have an external enemy? And, if we think about like American history, the times we were most united were the times we had this big external enemy, like the Soviet Union, right? And the Nazis and all that, like all that good stuff in the 20th century that like was super scary, but made us feel really united with not only our fellow Americans, but with the free world, right? It was a thing. And so what's my point? My point is that, I remember in the 2000s and well up through, well into 2016, there was a sense that the Republicans were very good at being united. And because they have this siege mentality. Now, I don't know how, I don't want to paint Republicans with too broad a brush, but I listen to a lot of conservative talk radio and especially growing up, and my personal take is that there was a siege mentality that conservative values under attack, Christianity is under attack, being white is under attack, all that stuff, and so that siege mentality meant that they fell into line because there's this external enemy, the entire Republican Party is one big tribe, and we're going to stay behind each other. And conventionally, I think the wisdom is that the Democrats were bad at that, and that for example, in 2016, the Sanders-Clinton nomination was bitter. A lot of Sanders voters said they would never vote for Hillary Clinton. She's an evil neoliberal or whatever. She represents the establishment. A lot of Sanders voters didn't turn out, or they voted for Trump. And so you had this very united front where a lot of Republicans held their noses and voted for Trump back then, and then came out much more enthusiastically in 2020. And Democrats didn't do that. And I get the sense, actually, in 2020, that the Democrats were far more united than I've ever seen them. I think because of this external enemy, because they hated Trump so much, that even Sanders, right? Sanders could have cried foul, been like, effing, come on, guys. You were just stacking the deck against me as hard as you can by all y'all getting together and saying, oh, it's going to be Biden, right? We're not going to have an open contest. It's not going to be a battle royale. We're all just backing Biden in order to stop Bernie, right? Poor me. Which kind of happened in 2016 and super did not happen this time. And I wonder to what extent, are the Democrats going to be able to keep a sense of unity out of their sense? And maybe I'm even wrong about the sense of unity, and this is where you can kick my butt a little bit. But are the Democrats going to be able to keep a sense of unity over the next 4 years, especially if Trump becomes the nominee or someone else they really hate, like Ted Cruz, becomes the nominee? Or are they going to start to fracture again into their moderate neoliberal wing and the progressive wing? And then also the Republicans, to what extent is their unity now threatened? Because you've got this side of the party that's McConnell and Sanders, and by God, even Lindsey Graham and Murkowski, who are like, can we just please have our party back? Right? Like, can we please just like move on and not be the Donald Trump show? And then you've got the Donald Trump show. And, you know, how much are they going to spend the next few years fighting with each other? And, you know, I don't know. My speculation is that the Democrats will do a decent job holding it together, and that the Republicans are like in for some, you know, in for years of infighting, depending on how well they do or don't purge Donald Trump from their collective psyche. But what do you think?
Yeah. So there's a lot there. So yeah, the old idea was that Republicans were sort of this hierarchical party, and the Democrats were a little bit more disorganized and fractious. I think there's been a revolution in media that is really the key to what has changed on the Republican side. Just Fox News and talk radio, I think their influence cannot be exaggerated. They've just really created a business. They've made news entertaining, and news being entertaining needs conflict.
Yes.
If you go back to the 2011 or the 2009 fight over Obamacare, I would suggest David Frum, who I don't like a lot of things, but he got basically canceled from the conservative movement because he was saying, look, you know, something's going to pass anyway. So maybe Republicans should just work with Obama and try to make it better. And that was just heretical. Now, they did pass it. And then Republicans ran on repealing Obamacare for the next seven years. And then they got power and they didn't even repeal Obamacare anyway. So you had this bill that they had no say over just because they were never serious about policy. Policy is not, is not fun for a mass audience. What's fun is Obamacare is going to create death panels and it's going to kill you. And, you know, this is socialism and this is the end of America. And then Obamacare passes and people forget about it. Does anyone say, oh, we need to repeal Obamacare in order to have a freedom? No, people have moved on. So this place where politics has become entertainment, I think, has contributed to sort of a lack of governance and more fractiousness within the Republican Party and more fighting. It's interesting. You talk about the Democrats. Why hasn't this happened on the Democratic side? It just seems like cable news, for example, is not a big fact. I mean, Democrats don't need it. Democrats have the more sort of literate mediums. So journalism and academia. And those people, not to say that those people are great and everything they think is correct, but it's more ideologically grounded in the sense that they have political preferences that they want to enact. It's not just, they're not just watching it as a reality show. Some people are, definitely some people are, but there are people on the Democratic side who are working towards political goals, I think, in a way that's less common among Republicans. And why don't Democrats split at the national level? I think it's because it's for that reason, because they're rationally pursuing certain goals, and tearing themselves apart in a divided country is only gonna help their opposition. Right. Look, they know Biden, but Biden is a consensus pick. So Biden comes along and he's moderate on economics compared to where Sanders and Warren was, but he's to the left of Obama, yeah. Right? And he's like that on all the social issues too, way to the left of Obama on how he talks about, you know, so-called racial justice, how he talks about trans in the military, all these things. And there's no daylight really between him and Sanders or Biden, Sanders or Warren. There's a little bit in the sense that like Warren announces her pronouns on her Twitter bio and Biden does not. So Biden appeals to sort of a more normal American voter in a way that Warren does not, and does not come across as extreme. But if you look at his policies on anything that could be called a racial issue or a social issue, he's very far to the left. So if you're a far left wing person in academia or journalism, I think you're happy with the way the Democratic Party is going. You're not you might want conflict. If you want a conflict for its own sake, then you'd go to war with Biden and say you have to just talk like us, and you have to stamp your foot. You have to stamp your feet, and you have to talk about Republicans.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yes, yes.
You have to adopt all like their tribal markers, like the tribal markers of like I'm a good, you know, like the what's it like, hold up the little red book and shake it around kind of thing.
Yeah, it was such a controversy when Chris Christie hugged Obama after Hurricane Sandy, and this just became a huge story among conservatives. It doesn't work like that on the left. There was Dianne Feinstein did hug Lindsey Graham during the Amy Coney Barrett hearing, and there were some people on Twitter talking about it. It wasn't the top story. It wasn't on anyone's radar as the main thing to be talking about, because they rationally knew that that didn't have any policy implication, right? While Republicans don't seem to care what has policy implication, they're sort of just, you know, they want the person who's going to stand up against Obama. They want someone who's going to say these words like cancel culture and our history is great and I'm against the 1619 Project and I'm for law and order. And also, war with the Democrats. That's important too. So Obama comes along and he's not doing it. His first major initiative is not a culture war issue. He's not trying to pass reparations or something. He's trying to do some mainstream liberal thing, give people health care, something that was, as people talk about, it was a Heritage Foundation plan. Indeed. It was a plan that, the kind of plan that could have been endorsed by Republicans a generation or two ago. And what's the reaction to that? The reaction is, this is socialism. He's a Kenyan. He wasn't born in America. And if they had that reaction to and something ideological, you can understand, but it's not. It's they've gotten these people hopped up and they've gotten them entertained. And it doesn't matter what the Democrats are going to do. The hyperbole and the talk and the idea that it's going to be socialism, radicalism, anti-Americanism. Right. It's like a very easy template that you can sell to the audience. So it's fascinating to think about the differences between the two parties. The tribal mind is sort of, it's similar. You'll see similar things like, you know, they'll accept or reject evidence based on what they want to believe. But I also feel at the same time, these are very, very different movements and people don't talk enough about that.
What I've been doing a little bit, just to kind of like keep my mind broad is I'm trying to look at how like different media outlets are reacting to Biden. And I'm looking right now at foxnews.com. And the first thing says Central America first. As Americans await stimulus checks, Biden offers $4 billion to migrant countries. Now, of course, the amount of money, I believe that President Trump specifically sent something like $50 billion to migrant countries in order. And the purpose is to limit the number of illegal immigrants that are coming up to the border, right? Like this is something that is like, it was like a central tenet of Trump's Trump's policy, right? And it was actually like one of the smarter things he did. He's like, oh, if we can like invest in these areas, people, you know, and there's more economic opportunity, people want to stay. Great. And but $4 billion, which is like, you know, couch cushion.
I'm a little skeptical about that theory that American aid is going to do all that much. But yeah, go ahead. That's besides the point.
It was certainly the idea, right? And yeah, I'm similarly skeptical about foreign aid in general, but it's a, what's my point? My point is that, you know, this is a small dose of what you just talked about regarding Obamacare, right? Here is something that Trump did, right? That was part of his policy that, you know, I'm going to say I don't have definitive evidence that Fox News didn't lambast, but I'm going to guess they didn't. That with Biden, it becomes Central America first, right? It's, and you have this sensationalist headline about it.
Well, yeah, and then go to MSNBC. I mean, just open the MSNBC, go open another tab, go to MSNBC, and I've done that now. And Biden's new goal, they're talking about Biden's vaccination goals. He's building pressure for COVID relief. Supreme Court tosses lawsuit. So this is biased, but it's news. Right. This is just talk. This is just talk radio. Yeah. The Central America first headline. There's not a equivalence here. Oh, here's another one on the Fox News. McCain has a message for Couric, Katie Couric. comma, libs,
yeah,
who want to deprogram Republicans. So like, it's, they always do these stories too. It's like Madonna or like Kathy Griffin said this or that. And right. Yeah, this is like half, I mean, this is not the whole front page. Welding foreman says he broke down as Biden order forced him to lay off team. I don't want to laugh at this poor welder, but I mean, this is, you could tell what the agenda is here. And this is Fox. Fox is like the most responsible on the right now. You know, the Trumpists hate them. Right. This is what their news is. Go to Epoch Times and see what they're talking about. That's like, you know, that it's run by some Chinese cultists. And you know, this is the only thing that's pure enough for Republicans now. It's going to a not very good place, unfortunately.
And maybe this is where I want to talk about what I think is the if there's going to be one big change in America from the Capitol riots. You know, you touched on it earlier. It's media is changing how it thinks about, well, media and everything around it, like the technology around media, is changing how it thinks about. Like how it thinks about its responsibility. And I actually recently gave a talk for MIT about this idea I have about this cycle in media of fracturing and consolidation, where new media technology allows anyone to say anything in this like kind of this new way that we're psychologically very vulnerable to, because we can make stuff that looks very credible. Like even with the printing press, it's like, ooh, people can print stuff on paper and send it to you. Like psychologically, like we only ever saw stuff written down if it was from the king or like the pope, right? And now anyone can print anything and like put it on a board. And, you know, famously, one of the first uses of the printing press was to run off a series of pamphlets about how Jews are conducting Satanist rituals and drinking baby blood. And actually led to a pogrom, right? It was awful. And if that sounds familiar, right, to like, really? People would believe such an outrageous lie and then go commit violence for it, right? Like, there's a reason it sounds familiar. And, you know, the consolidation phases happen as these technologies mature and people figure out what they want from them. And you know, corporations start to understand, you know, even thinking cynically, corporations start to understand that there's some demand for reliability. You know, Facebook's usage is dropping. I wonder to what extent, like, you know, people are kind of just like sick of getting on Facebook and just seeing misery all the time, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm, you know, and so you have these, you know, so I'm hypothesizing that we're in this phase of consolidation, and I'm using the word consolidation rather than censorship, even though there is censorship, because we're actually used to this. We're used to, like, in the past having, you know, a couple TV, you know, like we had ABC, NBC, CBS as our news options. And it was the Walter Cronkite era. And there was this like small Overton window about what we talked about. And there were, you know, there was a consolidation of newspapers after the yellow journalism era, where there were like new journalistic standards about what you can and, you know, you will and won't print. And that seems to be happening. Like, it seems that maybe there's a beginning of that with this new form of media, social media. What's interesting about it, of course, is that there seems to be a movement to consolidate what can be projected or amplified, even though it's like someone else's speech, right? It's like what Donald Trump wants to say. It's what you and I want to say, not what an editorial board wants to say. But there seems to be this sense that, you know, we won't. Like we as Twitter or Facebook or even, you know, AWS or Google, right, regarding Parler, we won't, you know, we're adopting some sort of journalistic standards or the equivalent of it to at least catch the violent edges of the Overton window, because we either we feel like we have some responsibility or the consumer is demanding some responsibility from us. And what I'm trying to think about and understand better is like to what extent is this just like a natural cycle and like maybe even a good thing? To what extent are we seeing that a few corporations are indeed very powerful and that's kind of scary? You know, that you know, Twitter can change its terms of service whenever it wants, right? They do change it all the time. I know that. I don't read what changed, but I get the update that it did change. And so to what extent are these, you know, to what extent are these corporations out, you know, outsized in power, for their ability to either amplify, right? Because they can use algorithms to amplify and show something to everyone versus suppress. information. And with that big pile, I just want to turn it over to you.
There's a lot there. So are we in a period of consolidation of power? I think there was a trend towards sort of a deconsolidation. When the internet was really free, social media things could take off. These internet personalities were at some point rivaling the major news networks and their YouTube viewership and how they were doing on Google algorithms. I mean, when you put, like, you just make a neutral algorithm that's going to give you search results or give you videos on YouTube, there's no guarantee that it's going to end up with CNN and ABC and NBC and the New York Times at the top of it. There's nothing on earth. And then you come back later and you say, well, these are the objective sources of news, or at least the credible sources of news. And I don't think that that's completely wrong. I think that they do have some journalistic standards. So we shouldn't just act like that doesn't exist. But then you sort of play with it a little bit and you have the algorithm where you bring us back to the world where it originally was. Still, though, they've lost some control. So Facebook, there's a guy named Kevin Roos who follows tech for the New York Times. And on his Twitter, he occasionally just lists the top 10 most popular posts on Facebook for the day. I don't know if they're top 10 most political or just top 10 overall. But they're always, and who always does well there is Ben Shapiro, Don Bongino. I don't know if you know who this guy is. He's some kind of right-wing personality, former cop. Or Secret Service. I think he's former Secret Service. Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son. And it's always like that. It's always like these sort of conservative, mainstreamish figures. You know, they banned all the far right people from Facebook, right? so still, you know, they have Ben Shapiro on, and Ben Shapiro ends up dominating Facebook because there's a there's a desire for something that's not the mainstream, that's not as left wing. And then you have that. I mean, you have Facebook, which is sort of an amplification device for a lot of right-wing things, even though that's not what the company intended. That's sort of the way it ended up. Their Facebook is sort of an old person's place, and Twitter is more a young person's platform.
Right.
And so you have that. But at the same time, like, I don't think Ben Shapiro and Don Bongino are running the country. I think what they're doing is, I think these voices are doing better within the Republican Party. Just, you know, it's sort of this that we talked about, talk radio and Fox News becoming the dominant voice in conservatism. It's become simpler than that, where it's not even like Rush Limbaugh clips. It's like a meme, right? Or like a 5-minute, you know, discourse by Diamond and Silk, or it's something like that. I saw you talked about the printing press and this new technology made things seem credible. I saw something, there was something being passed around. It was a Photoshop, right? Anybody can use Photoshop now. And it claimed to be looked like a CNN screenshot. And it said, Antifa claims responsibility for Capitol Hill. And it's spelled capital. You know how it's spelled, capital, C-A-P-I-T-A-L.
Oh yeah, so they spelled it wrong.
Yeah. But people dumb enough to fall for this, you know, don't know how to spell capital. So this was getting passed around. Anyone can do Photoshop now. That used to be a wizardry, right? Anyone could do that and make a screenshot of CNN saying anything in the world.
Yeah, and I'm sometimes flabbergasted at how much people fall for a photo with a caption. Right. Like, here's a photo. And I just wrote some text around underneath about what's going on. Right. And like, you know, grandma is going to share it and be like, see, Obama is a Satanist. And I go like, come on, grandma, like someone put some words on a picture. And by the way, the picture's Photoshop. Right? Like literally all this is fake. And what I remembered at some point as I was thinking about this kind of like how media technology changes and how it impacts us. Well, grandma grew up in an age where literally there were two places you saw a photo with a caption. One of them was like a very well-established newspaper, and one of them was a school textbook. Like, that was it, right? And so like photo with caption, our brain, you know, her brain was programmed in her young life to say, a photo with a caption, like this is credible, right? Because it's a trusted source. You know, it's always some sort of like fairly trusted source who is using the photo and caption in order to try to add color to a broader story, right? And the broader stories around it, right? Like you read a newspaper, like I'm going to try to pick something that's not as controversial. I don't know, the Boston Herald, right? I actually really like the Herald. And you know, in the Boston Herald, it's a little more right wing. Wall Street Journal, right? Actually, I read it voraciously. So Wall Street Journal, like, they have the picture and caption. They also have everything else around it saying, you know, here's the evidence. Here are the people we talked to, right? Like, here are the citations. Here are quotes by real individuals. Here are some stats, right? All that stuff. But the picture and caption adds flavor or adds color, like helps you understand it better. And sometimes I go through the you know, the Wall Street Journal and I just like look at the picture and caption, right? And it will be like, you know, it'll be a picture of, let's just say like Biden signing a thing. And it says, Biden is signing an executive order to do XYZ. And I believe it, right? I believe the Wall Street Journal when they say this picture of Biden signing this thing, right? It's this specific executive order. I don't doubt it for a second. And grandma goes, right? Yeah. Like someone forwarded something that's like, here's a picture of Obama, I don't know, signing an executive order to like drink baby blood. Right. And she's like, see, right. Horrible guy. And I think it's just because of the, yeah, I think it's because of like this like psychological conditioning that we have, which like sounds bad, but I think it's just natural that like you can't go through. I think that's what's so hard about this age that we're in of how rapidly media technology accelerates and changes is that it's actually just super impossible for humans to go through life needing a ton of evidence and citation checking and fact checking to function. But you have to trust things or you're paralyzed.
Yeah. And I guess the difference between people like me and you is, well, yeah, when I read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and they say there's an executive order that's going to happen, I believe it, right? If the New York Times says all the evidence says all racial disparities are caused by systemic racism, I have some skepticism of that. So that's a different kind of
right.
fact that they want to put in the same universe. But look, we're sophisticated guys who can differentiate. Now, somebody with maybe who grew up in a less sophisticated age, someone who's not as smart, someone who doesn't have time to know what's a reputable news source and what's not, or has never had time or...
Well, and also what are the biases of the news source, to your point about the New York Times.
Yeah. So yeah, you have some people who will read the New York Times and swallow every word, and not just the, you know, the facts, but also the opinion and the spin and the ideology they consider facts. And you have other people some Photoshop screenshot on Facebook is just as good as a New York Times reporter, right? And so you have both these problems. I don't know what the solution is. People say, we have to teach critical thinking skills. We have to teach media literacy. Like, I don't know, maybe. I don't know if that can work. I mean, you tell people, you said people in public school and you say the New York Times is good. You listen to them and your friends on Facebook are not. Like, you can't force people to want to buy that. People didn't want to buy that in the first place. That's why you need to teach them, quote unquote, you know, media literacy. So the problem is humans, I guess.
Well, here's maybe where like my theory actually gets interesting is that, you know, humans are a constant force in this, right? And I studied mechanical engineering before I bailed out and studied political science. And I'm thinking about like, if you have in like a dynamic system, if you have like a constant force and you have, so like a flat line on the graph and you have this like sinusoidal force going in, you can have this like awesome amplification thing that can lead to resonant frequency and like literally tear something apart. Right. So there's this like cool video I love showing people when they're like, what's resonant frequency? I'm like, it's a Chinook helicopter. So two rotors, right? And those rotors are spinning just like a little bit out of phase. And the thing literally tears itself to pieces because of resonant frequency. And so anyway, that's a like convoluted way of saying like you have human nature, which is constant. And I agree. I think like trying to, and I think because of that constancy and like the deep subconscious ways that our brains interface with the world and decide what to trust and decide what to accept, right? I'll dive a little bit more into that to get your thoughts in a sec. But then around it, what's changing is the media technology and what we're exposed to. That's changing all the time. And so, you know, and if we look back to this, like maybe it wasn't like, maybe, you know, that there's this idea of like the American consensus age, and maybe it wasn't actually true, but it's like certainly kind of seems so, you know, Congress voted together more often and people cross party lines. And the, you know, there is all this stuff that suggests like an America where people had a shared narrative about what was real. right? And they had different opinions, but they had the shared narrative. So let's just...
Yeah, I mean, COVID broke out in like the 1970s or 1980s. I don't think you would have had half the country who said this thing is not real.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. And so, I mean, I guess, you know, we could think about why it gets better or worse. And you're right, the media technology is huge. And I think what happened before the internet was, you know, people weren't that much smarter. They would have fell for the same things 20 years ago, but they weren't exposed to it. They were bored. I mean, all you had was the nightly news and CNN, and like if you were the Wall Street Journal, and that was boring. Even like Rush Limbaugh would be boring to somebody who doesn't care about ideas at all, right? It's not like QAnon. QAnon is a soap opera that's fascinating to anyone, right? If you're simple enough to buy it, that can't be boring. And so we've perfected this sort of politics as entertainment. Now, how do we get back to a place where we're somewhere connected to reality? I mean, one way I think the media, they don't say this explicitly, but maybe they do. The idea is you just have like big tech have a heavy hand. So big tech comes in and they say, right, this is high quality information. You know, you ever look at Twitter when you have like the show more replies and you ever click on that? And they usually do a good job. Like the show more replies guys are like awful. They're always like, F you, or like, one of them today told me, shut your bitch ass up, because I compared Tom Brady to Colin Kaepernick. And I said, people were saying there was Tom Brady can have politics and people separate, but Colin Kaepernick doesn't. And I'm like, well, the difference is Brady like had a hat once and he didn't just like talk about politics all the time. And also Brady's the greatest quarterback ever. Well, Kaepernick obviously is not. And I was like, shut your bitch ass up, right? That's on their show more replies. I don't know why I clicked there. Sometimes the people who are in show more replies are people I know. I don't know how they got down there. There's just some algorithm. They follow the wrong person. Right. They use the wrong word at some point. And they're going too far, right? And they're putting people who have something to contribute to the discussion. They're best secluded. So, that's one option. You sort of make the internet more like what things were like before the internet, which was just TV and newspapers and a few gatekeepers.
Gatekeepers. That's the trick. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So a few gatekeepers deciding on things. And yeah, I mean, like, I don't particularly like this vision. I don't trust them to, you know, not go overboard with the censorship. But at the same time, I've like realized that it's gotten really dumb. And like, if it's not bad, I don't know what else it would be, right? Gatekeeping sounds bad, but just letting, you know, people run wild and people without the ability to see truth from fiction or differentiate opinion from fact or what they want to believe and what's true. I mean, we've been sort of overcome with that. And if, you know, people have ideas how we get away from that, I'm willing to listen, but I haven't been able to come up with anything.
Yeah, that's what I think is really the crux of it, is that like during the age of consensus, we had like three TV news networks and a couple newspapers, and they all had heavy, hardcore gatekeeping. And a big part of it was that because there were fewer of them, the economic strategy was to appeal to as broad an audience as possible. Whereas when you have a saturated market, you go after niches, right? So like the Wall Street Journal wins by having a lot of people kind of like it.
Great
point. And, OANN or like Charlie Kirk wins by having like a few people really like him. And those people, like, how do you get people to really like you? Or like, you make them angry, right? And you make them really emotional and they become attached. And that's, I think, like the crux to the cycle is this like twofold sense of, well, it's really one thing. It's like when you have fewer options, those options will implement more gatekeeping and more journalistic standards in order to appeal to as broad an audience as possible, because that's actually what the market demands, because you can't afford to just like alienate 98% of people and just get 2%.
Yeah, I don't think it's just I think you're right to focus on the market forces is important, but I don't think that's the entire story. So when there was always a market, like if CNN wanted to be like Fox News, CNN, you know, was there a few years before, a few years, I think a decade or something before Fox News, they could have done that. And it might have actually been good business, because CNN was this new thing, this 24-hour news channel, but they could be that plus be conservative, right? That's the thing. There was the market, Fox filled a niche, right? There was more, a lot of newspapers, a lot of places could have actually done better by going right. And they didn't because, you know, they were journalists and they had an ideology. And that mattered too. Yep. And part of it is like, you know, some of the right-wing things they didn't buy in because they care about facts and standards. Sometimes they didn't buy into the right-wing narrative because they had their own left-wing narrative. And maybe the right-wing narrative was actually correct on some things, right? But there was also right. either this, you know, ideology or this sense of standards and propriety where, and you could do this when there's only a small number of players, right? When there's like four of them.
Right.
Five,
right.
They can have like a cartel, right? Where the cartel doesn't give the customer what it wants. And here, maybe it's good not to give the customer what it wants, right? And so it's a cartel. It's an ideological cartel. But they were responding to market incentives, but at the same time, they were not responding to market incentives. They put something above them,
that's a great point.
Maximizing profit. Now you have unlimited number of content creators, you know, all over. And you're right. Something right. like that is just not going to hold. The technology is not going to allow it. So yeah, you get your silos and your 8chans and your 4chans and your Breitbarts and your, you know, everything in between. Right.
Right. And so Eric Fogg's personal prediction for the future is that you have more players starting to see themselves as this gatekeeper, or maybe a better word for it is a clearinghouse, right? Like print publishers are clearinghouses, newspapers are clearinghouses, right? Like, oh, this is actually like super legit. Let's publish it. And super legit and matches our idea of what's good, of course. And that's always the dangerous part, but like it's been a part of society in the past. And we, you know, kind of to your point about Obamacare, like we can kind of get used to anything. It's the change that really freaks us out. And then like 10 years later, we've forgotten about it.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 months. But I think we're starting to see, you know, Google and Apple, their app stores starting to see a role of being a clearinghouse for not necessarily for like good and bad think. Although the hard part is they have the power to do that, right? Like as soon as you have the power to be a clearinghouse for one thing, you can do it for something else. And that's always the hard part, but it's always been true. I think people have this idea that like, ooh, suddenly there are these corporations that have the power to be clearinghouses for what we get exposed to and what we don't. It's like, yeah, they always have, right? There was this like very brief interlude from about like, you know, the late 90s to now that, you know, that it was a bit Wild West and like the outcome isn't good. And so, you know, are we like, should we be, you know, should we be like kind of like comfortable with reverting back to this idea that like, yeah, there are going to be some corporations that serve as clearinghouses for, you know, one, like making sure that patently false information gets fact checked, two, that like apps that, you know, like social networks or something or publications that like encourage violence are squished, right? And they're just going to play whack-a-mole forever. Because it will be whack-a-mole, right? It's never going to be done. It's like the war on terror, right? It's endless. But my personal prediction is that like we've seen the beginning of these tech companies realizing that their role is the fourth estate. They're part of the fourth estate, right? And the media, like we knew in the past that the media was like, it's more than a corporation. It is like part of society and like it needs to do things right to function. And it has that power. Yes, it has to use it responsibly. Yes. And if it doesn't use it responsibly, we're effed. And then, kind of like gestures around, to everything on fire, right? Like that's what happened. You know, like what we see now is kind of what happened when the fourth estate lost their power over the narrative. And there are people who really like that, obviously. And there are a lot of us who are looking around being like, man, the world's a little crazy right now. But I think we're starting to trend back towards that as these new players start to realize they're part of the fourth estate and that those same practices that the fourth estate had in the past are really important. That's my thought.
Yeah. I mean, that's one vision. The thing is, it's hard to...
That's one way of thinking about it, Eric. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. I mean, the thing is, we still have politics, and we still have two political parties, and we still have one that just because it's one of the two political parties, it sort of has a voice in this thing. And, you know, you can't, you know, there's norms or whatever will not let you cancel one half of our political system. And so it really depends on where the Republicans go. I mean, And I saw somebody tweeting today, you know, the crazy people have taken over the parties at the state level. Like, is Mitch McConnell and Ronna McDaniel going to do something? I don't think they can do anything. Right. The Arizona GOP and the Texas GOP and some of these other places have gone crazy. And Mitch McConnell can't go remake the local Republican Party. It's just with Trump and with social media, a certain kind of person has been drawn into politics and they've all gone to one place. So I mean, if I was going to, you know, say where we're going, I think it's a lot more of the same. I mean, I think you're going to have these people try to be gatekeepers, and they've done it a little bit. I don't know if it's going to go any more. Like, there was a big wave of sort of censorship in 2016 and 2017 after Trump won. Like, these alt-right and alt-light figures got on social media, and those people had like a different ideology than the ruling class. It wasn't like QAnon, where there's no ideology besides you're all pedophiles and Trump is awesome. They were kicking people off for actual ideas, and now they've gone and they're going to do QAnon, and they're going to kick them off for being crazy. It should have been kicked off before the other stuff, because it's not really contributing to human knowledge or the public conversation in any way. So are they going to go and they're going to ban more ideas? I don't know. I think you. So you're gonna have this place where everything stays the same, basically. You have the Democrats, and they're trying to do incremental things on social policy and economic policy, and you have Republicans sort of just talking about cancel culture and without many ideas about what to do about it. And you know, science and technology and markets will go on. The Moderna vaccine, it just came out. We were so slow with dealing with COVID. And even though vaccines were produced fast, we could have gotten a lot faster with just not going through some of the regulations at the FDA. And the people were thinking, well, it's gone on so long, there's going to be virants, they're going to be immune. And Moderna just announced today that the vaccine works on the South Africa strain and on the British strain. So, you know, science out again, despite us being very, very incompetent. So there's going to be good technological and scientific developments. You know, some things like you can't regulate because you're so broken, like you can't do anything. So you can't deal with COVID. You can't build high speed rail, but you can't like regulate any great technology to death if it's like something brand new. So there's no dynamism in society. And so like the fact that our politics is broken gives room for things to happen. But man, I was on some other podcasts and I talked about like how America's not going to have a civil war. That became, you know, I wrote the Washington Post piece on that, and people have invited me over on their shows that I've talked about. That. It just sounds like I'm like an optimistic guy about America, right? Or, and like here I am, I'm telling you, like our politics are broken, our people are not doing well, and we can't solve any problems, and I don't see much prospect for changing that. So I don't know if I'm really all that optimistic. I just don't think we'll be killing each other, but I don't think there's going to be anything romantic or great that we're going to be doing either, at least through government. But like I said, the private sector is a different thing.
Right. Well, actually, we've hit our hour, which I've been advised by some listener surveys not to go too far over, and I really think this is actually like a good. We've got this like good ending point, right? Like we've gotten through kind of like short term warbles that you know in the system. You know, it got this like big impulse, right? Again, I'm now thinking about my mechanical engineering days. Big impulse into the system. How springy is it? How dampening is it? And how much is it going to like regress to the mean? Versus like kind of spin off in a new direction. And what I love in particular is that we are going to leave our listeners without a strong consensus, which is, look, if reconsider is ever telling y'all what, if we're ever telling y'all what to think and we're too confident about it, something's gone wrong. And it's one of the nice things about speculating on a podcast is like, well, look, we're not in charge anyway. Like we don't get to decide what happens. I guess my parting thought for everyone is, you know, is as you're like navigating some of the, you know, as you're navigating some of the reactions to the Capitol riots and just all the muck that led up to it and all the fallout from it, you know, history is a good friend here for trying to like get a sense of it. Rich and I talked about how, you know, how media technology has changed and how that's impacted society in very dramatic ways, and that you know, at least from my perspective, like, and I think Richard, you agree a little bit, like some of what's being talked about now in terms of consolidation and censorship isn't brand new. It's an echo of the past. But, you know, and I think like the other guide for trying to make sense of this is just thinking about human nature and how it collides with the media technology that we've seen, that at least like for your own personal sanity, you know, being able to model what's going on around you makes it a little bit less personal, at least. And I think that's the like that's the best guidance, or that's the best I have for everyone at this point in terms of a takeaway. Richard, anything you want to say on the way out?
No, this was fun. I think that in the Trump years, you know, there's a hope that politics is not going to be dominating our lives as much, at least the superficial, right, stupid parts of politics. All the news in the last week. So Biden was inaugurated just today's January 25th. So 5 days ago. And all the news has been about things that he's done mostly. Like he signed executive orders. Some you may agree with, some you may disagree with, or he's got a policy on minimum wage or that, but that's like all we've been talking about. Right. And this is a bit refreshing, but like a bit boring because, you know, we're not saints here. Part of me, at least, really enjoyed the Trump, you know, horror show. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't feel good about that, but for the country as a whole, it's better if we're going to be talking about these issues than if we're going to be, you know, talking about who Trump called fat on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, whatever his latest scandal is. So.
Well, unlike you, I like boring things. I do enough to keep myself entertained already. I will leave everyone with my favorite Chinese curse, which I learned in China when I worked there. And as a reminder, or as just a tiny little bit of perspective over the last 4 years, and the curse goes as such: may you live in interesting times.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.